Tech Talk with Jess Kelly on News Talk.
Thanks to Harvey Norman. From setup and support to full repair, our Love Tech teams at Harvey Norman are here for the lifetime of your technology.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, I'm in Nashville for Work Human, the annual conference that looks at the future of work. Over the next hour, I'll sit down with the CEO of Irish company Work Human to hear about their new jobs for Dublin, plus why humanity means more than ever before in the office. I'll meet the man who studied meetings for 20 years to learn about the science of getting it right, and we'll find out about the Wondery. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or tweet with #TechTalkNT. Now, there's been a lot of talk in recent months about the future of work. Questions like how is technology changing what we do and where do we fit in have been asked. And there's also been a lot of exploration about what issues will arise from the shift that's already occurring. I spent the week at Work Human, which is an annual gathering of HR professionals from around the world who explore the issues facing their different industries. I managed to catch up with CEO of Work Human, Eric Mosley, who told me about the event, but also his business as a whole.
It's a very exciting time for Work Human. This year, I would have to say, over the last 12 months, we've had an incredible surge of activity and growth with the company. From our Work Human conference in Nashville this week is, you know, six times the size it was a couple of years ago. Our company has obviously grown. We're investing heavily in the Dublin market. All of our global innovation is done in Dublin. And we're producing more and more products that are used by some of the world's largest companies around the world. There's 4.5 million employees in 150 countries on our software platform, all giving and receiving awards, giving and receiving feedback to their colleagues. And all of those products, that's incredible volume. All of that product suite, that platform, is developed in Dublin. So we're very proud of the work that we do there, and we want to bring more and more people into that office, that innovation centre.
So you recently changed the name from Global Force to Work Human, which is a very interesting name at an interesting time when all the fear is that the robots are going to come and take our jobs and there's not going to be humans working anymore. Yeah. Tell me the thinking behind that, and then also the message that it sort of pushes out there.
Well, we started the Work Human conference about 4 years ago. This is our fifth Work Human conference, and it just took off. And it's, as I said, six times the size it was only three years ago. And as a brand, as a concept, it was embraced by the HR community globally. And so as a brand, it became bigger than Global Force, became bigger than us. And we realized that we should bring those two things together. So it used to be that we were a company and we had this Work Human mission. Well, now we're a mission, this Work Human movement, with a company attached. And our product suite, the Work Human Cloud, our company, and the conference and all the online communities and social media that we have attached are all under the central Work Human brand, because it speaks for itself. It's so easy to explain. It's basically about you work in a company. It's about bringing a little bit of humanity to the workplace. So we create products that make work more human. Mm-hmm. Simple as that.
And I know that you're all about practicing what you preach, and so that your workforce are very happy and so on. How important is it to value the human in this technological era? And do you think that it's going to become more important to reward your staff for the humanity that they bring to a business?
Yeah, I think companies these days, especially innovation companies, there's always a spotlight in the press and in commentators about whether those offices have, you know, beanbags and ping pong tables. Ultimately, over time, what employees respond to is feeling like they're part of a community, feeling like they're part, that they have friends and colleagues in work, they feel like their core human needs are being met. People's core human needs are things like the need for to be appreciated, to feel the need that somebody notices when you do good work, that you get positive reinforcement for that, and then the need for connection with other human beings. And so ultimately the sheen wears off some of those quirky perks, and what's left is, as a human being in the workplace, do you feel connected and that the work that you do matters? You know, are you working on a just cause? that motivates you to do the best work of your life. And so at WorkHuman, we are obviously bringing humanity to the workplace in all over the world for some of the world's largest companies. There's 4+ million employees live on our platform in 150 countries around the world. And so, of course, the answer to that is, yes, it is a just cause. Yes, we are bringing humanity to all of these companies, and our employees feel connected and feel the rewards for that. And of course, we have all those quirky perks too.
You have to have them. I flew from Dublin to Nashville through Boston, and I think every person on the plane with me was a WorkHuman employee, and the accents were great, but also so were the stories of, you know, what the company is trying to do. You announced, as I mentioned earlier, some new jobs. Are those jobs Dublin jobs, or are they Dublin-Boston jobs? Is the investment going to continue to happen on both sides of the Atlantic?
Well, all those jobs we announced are Dublin-only jobs. So, as I said, we do all of our innovation and development in Dublin. And we have a lot of other departments there and support staff from logistics to operations. And so we are building that office and the infrastructure around it. Mm-hmm. We are also growing elsewhere as well. So in the US, we are also growing. The company grew last quarter 50%. So obviously, we're always investing in marketing and sales. And in the US, we will be growing. But the Dublin office has grown faster than anywhere else over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you're based here in the US, but when you come back to the Dublin office, have you, you know, noticed any big changes in Dublin as a tech hub? Because we do have some of the biggest tech companies in the world based there. The city is under pressure in certain regards when it comes to housing and office space and so on. Is that palpable to you when you come home?
I would say yes. I think the talent market in Dublin is just being radically made more competitive over the last few years. It's just unbelievable to see. It's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic for the city and for the economy as a whole. It makes hiring harder, but the talent base has also been improved in terms of the exposure that the Irish tech community has had to world-beating technologies has actually risen as well. So we always feel that we're in a great position because our engagement of our employees, the kind of energy that they bring to work, is much higher than normal companies. And that's because these employees feel connected to the community that they work in. They feel like they are doing some of the best work that they've ever done, and so the loyalty that we enjoy is fantastic. We also were out in Park West, and being out in Park West is something that for many employees is actually a real benefit. It's a very easy kind of commute for a lot of people, so there's real benefits to being out there. We've got a lot more space, we've a lot more ease of transport. Mm-hmm. So it makes for an incredible community.
Mm-hmm. And finally, you mentioned there that the past 12 months have been exciting from WorkHuman's point of view. What's coming down the tracks for the next 12?
Well, more of the same. The pace never ends. It's exhausting. we're releasing more products. Today we announced a new version of our platform that's suitable for small to medium sized enterprises and even small teams in bigger companies. So from now on, you'll be able to go on to our workhuman.com website and set yourself up, set your own company up with a recognition program. And we will be continuing to invest, releasing new versions of that throughout the rest of the year. We're investing heavily in all of the products in the suite.
That was Eric Mosley of WorkHuman. Now, whilst here in Nashville, I bumped into Jenny Darmody, who's the careers editor at siliconrepublic.com. This is very much her forte. And I asked her what the standout item of the week was.
One of the best sessions I have to say that I actually went to was one about when a coworker dies in the workplace. It was quite an interesting and unusual subject matter and a very, very serious one, but it was a really, really practical guide. It was from a woman called Jennifer Crowe. She's a grief and trauma consultant. And it was giving really practical guidelines of how to deal with that sort of thing, because it's not something that would come up quite often, but it's something that would be very serious to have to deal with all the employees. And also it went into a lot of tips on how to deal with anyone who would be dealing with grief, which is a lot more common. You know, if anyone had anyone passing away in the workplace, it's quite a human thing to have to deal with and not something that would be dealt with quite often. So I thought that was a really interesting standout session.
I was intrigued because this is my second time at this conference, and when you arrive you get a little booklet and it gives you a rundown on all the sessions, and so many of the topics sort of made me cock my head going, oh, didn't expect that. You know, when you come to something like this, you sort of expect the do's and don'ts of the workplace, which they do, but then they also tackle things like Me Too and Time's Up and so on. Just give us an overview of the sense of the week and what are the big issues that you picked up, because obviously this is your forte. What are the key talking points in the land of HR right now?
I think what I find really interesting about this conference is that while there is a lot of technology in the HR industry and there's a lot of things that are evolving there, this isn't really what was covered in this conference. And I think a lot of things are moving in the HR industry towards that more sort of where we really do employ human beings, and we need to sort of take our heads out of the technology and the things that will improve processes and streamlining recruitment. And we need to really look at, you know, how we deal with employees on an individual level, because no one process will actually fit everyone, and everyone has different experiences, and for every bureaucratic process you put in place there will be an exception to that. And I think it was interesting that a lot of sessions, particularly around harassment, as you said, the Me Too movement, things like that, all sort of hinge on, you know, there is no one size fits all for things like that, and there was a lot of sessions about how to deal with that and giving HR people the tools to do that without a very specific step-by-step, and this is what you do and then this is what you do. It's more understanding sort of an empathetic side of, you know, how employees deal with those things.
Yeah, there's kind of a misconception at the moment, because a lot of conversations are happening about the future of work, mm-hmm. and it's all like, oh my God, the robots are going to come and take our jobs. But what I took from this week is exactly what you're saying, and that there's like the future of work is very much based on humans, and while the jobs that we do will change, there's no denying that, the issues that we face as employees, regardless of what our job title is, will remain the same.
I love the conversation around the future work, because it did evolve over the last couple of years from, oh my God, robots are going to take our jobs, to everyone kind of calming the world down to say, no, they're really not. And then there was a big conversation around how employees can sort of adapt to the future and how their skills will develop. And a lot of that was to do with human skills, you know, creativity, fostering your communication. It's not about technical hard skills, and particularly things that automation and robots can actually, you know, replicate, but they can't replicate things like creativity. And now from a HR perspective, it's also moving towards, okay, let's stop looking at the robots that can make our job easier, and let's focus on the things that robots will never be able to do.
And so when you come to an event like this, and I know you've been to similar events, you know, are there actual takeaways, or is it like, you know, let's just hug each other and make the world a better place?
I think there are some takeaways that are a little bit more concrete than simply saying, you know, we are all human beings. And that is a really important one to remember, because even as I said, the highlight session for me was that when a coworker passes away. And that was one of my favorite things about that was it talked about a very specific process of like bereavement leave, which is a standard, you know, 3 to 5 days straight after it happens, mostly for family members. And that's just not how the world works anymore. You could be a lot closer to a best friend than, you know, your own siblings. Mm-hmm. And also grief might not hit you for 3 months. And what do you do then when you need the time off? So I think giving HR people the tools to understand, you know, what differences they can make to affect humans that aren't just, okay, we'll put a new process in place. Making them understand that there's never one process, mm-hmm. is a really key thing. And it's not so much, let's all just give everybody a big hug, but it's understanding that no matter what they do, they'll never stop coming across a new situation. Mm-hmm. And it's giving them the kind of tools to be able to deal with those situations.
And stepping away from Work Human and just about the sort of the industry of careers at the moment, What is it that people are looking for when they want to work in the tech sector? You know, is there particular trends? When we were talking to Eric earlier on in the show, we were saying that it's not about, you know, the beer keg and the ping pong table anymore. We seem to have kind of come down the other side of that roller coaster now. So what do you see? What are the trends that you're noticing?
I think a lot of people are looking to work at places that have actual value and meaning, that does something for them and, you know, aligns with their values and things like that. And the ping pong tables are still there, but people don't use them as much. And sometimes people even see them as a thing that's like, oh, do they want me here all the time? And I need to relax at like 6 o'clock in the evening because I'm going to be here till 8. So they're there, but they're not as pushed upon anymore. And even the sort of well-being side of things, that's all very important. A lot of companies have yoga studios, meditation studios, or, you know, like walks around the place to help them with their energy levels and things like that. But even that, I think, is not as what's really coming down the trend is the purpose and meaning. Like, what does this company actually stand for? Are they ethical? I think the generation that are coming up now are very conscious of companies that are doing the right thing, if anything, from environment to charities to minorities to diversity. And I think people are walking away from the companies that aren't making, you know, conscious efforts to change things. So that's, I think, what people are really looking for now, rather than salaries, ping pong balls, and or ping pong tables, I should say, and even the wellness stuff is like, that's all nice, but what do you do to change the world?
Mm-hmm. That was Jenny Darmody of SiliconRepublic.com. Coming up next, we head to the Wondery.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. I'm in Nashville this week learning about the future of work, but also about this fine town known as Music City. On Tuesday, I went to Vanderbilt University to meet Irish-American Robert Gajewski. He's the executive director of The Wondery, an innovation center at the heart of the college campus.
So The Wondery is the innovation center at Vanderbilt University. We're the epicenter for innovation and entrepreneurship on campus. We got launched in November of 2016. Since our opening, we've had over 50,000 people come through our doors, and we were recently recognized by the Global Consortium of Entrepreneurship Centers as the Emerging Outstanding University Entrepreneurship Center of the Year globally. So out of the 700 or 800 university entrepreneurship centers and innovation centers that exist around the world, we were seen as the best. And our goal is to be the sandbox for all academic disciplines to come together, to creatively collide, to explore innovation opportunities, experiential and immersive learning experiences, and ultimately a place where you can further flex, grow, create, and develop your innovation and entrepreneurial mindset.
Awesome, I love it. So give me an overview then of the types of people that come through the door here and what they're about.
Sure. So we specifically serve all academic disciplines here at Vanderbilt University. For those that don't know who Vanderbilt University is, we're based in Nashville, Tennessee. We're the top 15th university in the world. We are a liberal arts university. We have 10 colleges and schools on campus, from business and law to engineering and the sciences, and as well as the humanities. And essentially, we serve all of them. So from undergraduate students to graduate students to faculty and to staff, we are the place where you will come together to explore innovative endeavors and ultimately further explore inventions, creations, entrepreneurial starts that, you know, you're passionate about.
And so you've just told us there that it's a high-ranking university, and, you know, I wouldn't have thought this part of the country necessarily is a thriving hub of, you know, innovation, technology, science, but I'm so wrong.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So historically, when you think of innovation, venture capital, entrepreneurial hubs, at least in America, you historically think of the coasts. Mm-hmm. You think of Boston, you think of New York, you think of San Francisco and Silicon Valley. But honestly, in the past, you know, probably 10 or 15 years, you're beginning to see a resurgence kind of inside the, you know, inside the center of the country, including places like Nashville, places like Austin, places like Denver, places like Charlotte, North Carolina, that are really kind of coming alive. And the Kauffman Foundation, which is one of the major entrepreneurial nonprofit foundations in the country, recently ranked Nashville as the fifth most innovative city in the country. And we have over 100 people moving here a day. We have more cranes in the sky than New York and Austin and San Francisco. The city is really booming and is really exciting. And you may have recently heard about us because of Amazon's new headquarters. And so we were essentially HQ3. It originally went to, you know, obviously in the Washington, D.C. area, and then the New York City area, though they pulled back from there, and then Nashville was, you know, essentially a center for innovation that they're relocating a major part of their headquarters to now.
So it's kind of like a nice scene bubbling away. It's kind of like the best kept secret that I've come across in a little while. I know that healthcare is huge here, and like, it's one of, I think a cab driver told me that it's like a big industry for this part of town. Do you have people coming through your doors looking to innovate in that space in particular, or are there sort of breakouts that you're noticing trends in?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Despite Nashville being known as the quote-unquote music city, the home of country music, country and western music, we're actually, in fact, a healthcare city. I think about four or five of the major national healthcare providers that have their headquarters here in the Nashville area. Ultimately, industry, it is one of our biggest, if not the biggest, employer. So we are known as a bit of a healthcare town as well as a music town. We certainly see at Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt University Medical Center is the largest employer in the state outside of the state government for workers across the entire state. So we certainly see being, you know, the home and the headquarters of the medical center, a strong stream of healthcare ideas and healthcare aspiring innovators and entrepreneurs coming through to really work on, further develop, test, prototype some of the technologies that they're trying to do to improve care. But we also see that Nashville is growing. With 100 people moving here a day, with major tech giants and financial giants relocating here, like Amazon that I mentioned, AllianceBernstein is another major financial institution that's moving its headquarters here later this year. We're seeing a tremendous number of just smart people in other industries beginning to plant roots in Nashville. And they're doing that because the cost of living is nice. The weather is fantastic. We're centrally located. We have an amazing airport, international airport now. And ultimately, it's that just nice southern hospitality that really people want to collaborate and work together and want to do it in a way that really helps each other out. And so we're seeing a lot of other companies and other industries come to life here too, from bioinformatics, machine learning, data science, you know, a blockchain. You know, there is a tremendous number of other industries beginning to grow and kind of really begin to flourish in this area because there's just so much excitement and so much strong intellectual capital in this region.
With all of, you know, the people moving here, the 100 people a day and the building that's going on, because I did notice the cranes in the sky and when I was downtown, so many hotels being built. How do the locals feel about this? Because I know from Dublin, you know, when a new tech company announces 150 more jobs, we're like, great for the jobs, but where are they going to live? Is there, you know, any form of caution, I suppose, amongst the locals here in Nashville?
Sure, and a fabulous question. And I probably see a lot of synergies between Dublin and Nashville in terms of the growth and the excitement and just the young, fresh blood that's in the city. But you're 100% correct. You know, with positive growth, there's also growing pains. You know, we have some headaches and issues right now with traffic and infrastructure issues. The cost of living is still nice and certainly below the cost of living in San Francisco or London or New York or Boston, but it's increasing significantly, and that's an issue. Our city is doing some good efforts right now around affordable housing. They want to really focus on keeping Nashville special, and what makes Nashville unique is certainly being a creative city. Oftentimes, a lot of our creative folks are artists or musicians, those that are aspiring to be that next, you know, famous superstar or you know, are not in a financial situation to be able to afford to live downtown anymore, which is a travesty. And so that when that happens and when they move further and further away, you ultimately lose more culture. And so fortunately, our city, other nonprofits and other groups are stepping in to create environments, affordable housing, other areas that can ultimately help preserve some of that culture. So it certainly is an issue. I don't think we have it fully solved yet, but it is something that, you know, we're cognizant of and trying to build out our city correctly.
Mm-hmm. And then to pull back to what you do here at the Wondery, I mean, at what stage do people come to you with ideas? Is it when it's a post-it note, it's written down like in a Sharpie on a post-it note? Is it when they have some form of a plan and they just need guidance? And how hands-on do you get to be?
It really runs the gamut. You know, certainly we get the sketches on backs of napkins, as you mentioned, all the way up to, you know, companies that have had some sales and are looking to scale. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we help them along the journey, go from that concept to that reality and then, you know, to the next phase. You know, how we focus is we really our current focus is really around our students, our faculty, our staff, then the Vanderbilt alumni community, and then the external community, and that kind of descending order of focus. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we're able to prioritize a lot of our time, energy, and attention. But we really see ourselves as a facilitator and a connector. both for the external community to get engaged with Vanderbilt. We are that front door that where we can connect them, because we look down on the Vanderbilt dance floor from the balcony and kind of know where all the players are at and what they're doing. We can much more efficiently connect people to resources and vice versa. But also internally, helping out our own student, faculty, and staff community get better connected to each other and then to the city. Mm-hmm. Could they do that on their own? Certainly, but it probably would take a lot more time, be a lot less efficient, and ultimately have a lot less impact and be effective. And so, you know, for instance, here at Vanderbilt, since I've been here as the inaugural executive director of the Wondery, we've helped percolate and launch over 200 different companies. 150 of them have received funding. 30 of them received significant six-figure, seven-figure type funding in a kind of venture capital or SBI grants, non-dilutive funding. And then two have actually been acquired. So it's really been a tremendous hub of excitement and innovation on the entrepreneurial front. But we are an innovation center, and I must repeat that we certainly are here to help the next generation of Sergey Brin's and Sarah Blakely's and Mark Zuckerberg's kind of take that new idea to go change the world. But we're also here to help the artist, the thinker, the philosopher, the activist, just the problem solver, become much more innovatively minded, ultimately helping them approach situations in a way that is much more empathetic, uses a lot more human-centered design thinking, and ultimately helps bring together groups to help solve issues. They may not necessarily ever generate a dollar in revenue, but that solution that they come up with ideally improves the way we live in other ways.
I'm fascinated by the fact that you guys are part of the university, because not everybody is academically minded in terms of being able to read hundreds and hundreds of pages of text and then regurgitate it in an essay form. Some people have that natural entrepreneurial or inquisitive brain where they need to go make something, break it, and then talk about it. Is that a conscious decision to have this aligned alongside people who may not want to go down the pure academic route, but also still learn on the go while they're in their, you know, late teens, early 20s?
Absolutely. So Vanderbilt's strategic plan, our academic strategic plan, which is the guiding light for our university for the next, you know, 10 or 15 years, specifically focuses on immersive, immersion learning experiences, experiential learning experiences, really rolling up your sleeves and taking what is the academic theoretical learnings that you're getting in the classroom and being able to apply them in real world experiences. And the Wondery tends to be a catalyst for both helping create and launch those opportunities, but then also see them through to fruition and then some. And so our university recognizes that, you know, for us to stay competitive, for us to be a strong contributing member to society, for us to provide the best academic experience for our students and even our faculty and our staff and the community, we need to provide this real world opportunity for our students to really flex their muscles and flex their intellectual capacities. Mm-hmm. And that's no better way to do that than through these extracurricular, co-curricular, experiential, and immersive opportunities. So it's truly in the DNA of our university.
For a period there, it felt like entrepreneur was almost a dirty word, because everyone had to go and get a college degree. Even if you never used an ounce of information from that degree, you had to go through it. We seem to now be kind of coming on the other side, where it's okay to, you know, drop out after your first year if you have a really, really good idea. Do you think that we need to work on the messaging and to encourage those people who aren't academically minded? Or do you think that there's no harm in having, you know, that basis of 3 or 4 years of college education under your belt?
No, it's a great question, and certainly a tremendous amount of room there for debate. You know, I personally feel that people are on all their innovation journey. You know, some folks are ready to be entrepreneurs tomorrow. Some are entrepreneurs today. Some might be entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs 5, 10 years from now, or ultimately they may just be good problem solvers in whatever career that they choose. They can learn those innovation and entrepreneurial skills, ideally in a university environment where it's kind of structured and there's a safety net, and ultimately allows them to be better people longer term. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all students have to go to college or all people have to go to college. There's different routes to kind of getting those skill sets. And that's why I think cities, you know, high schools, trade schools, you know, ultimately other, you know, nonprofit organizations should provide these resources for those folks that don't want to go the traditional academic route, but maybe want to focus or specialize. Mm-hmm. But the great thing about a university and what I think makes us so special is that we have such a large amount of aggregated intellectual capital. We have faculty, students, and staff that come together from all around the world that are experts or aspiring experts in different academic disciplines. And when you bring them together in an inclusive environment into a sandbox like the Wondery, and you let those creative collisions happen, that's where you get the greatest amount of innovation and the creative thought, because you have such diverse perspectives coming together to work on problems from different viewpoints, different experiences, etc. You can't really get that just learning by watching YouTube videos or doing a Coursera, you know, at your house. You really need to be in an environment where that is really fostered and there's institutional infrastructure. Could you get there on your own? Could you network on your own? Could you eventually be successful? Certainly. But to maximize your chance, I think ultimately getting an academic university, you know, education is tremendously important. Furthermore, I think it helps you build problem-solving skills, resilience skills, maturity, things that you may not necessarily have, you know, at 17, 18 years old. Likewise, and most importantly, it helps you build a network, both a network with those that you go to school with today and the friendships that you build and the connections that you build and will continue to maintain upon graduation. But also you get this, you know, centuries at some schools old alumni network of people that have an affinity to something that you have an affinity to. And thus people are really willing to lend a hand, roll up their sleeves, help you out, make an introduction. That ultimately is sometimes the key to that early successes, that early traction to getting a new venture off the ground. So I don't think we could ever do away with universities. I see the value. I understand where it matters. But for certain folks, certainly there are other pathways to success.
And I won't keep too much more of your time, but I just want to talk briefly about the future of education, because on this show over the last few weeks, we've spoken a lot about the future of work, and we know that workplaces are changing and the robots are going to replace us all and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of education, how do like people like yourself and your colleagues ensure that when your students graduate, they are ready for the real world, the ever-changing workspace, and being able to stay one step ahead so that when they go into a workspace, they are the innovators. They weren't just kind of the nerds in the class, but they can bring something to a workforce.
Sure. No, absolutely. So as I may have mentioned, my background is in venture capital and entrepreneurship. I started my first company in my college dorm room after I aspired to be a professional athlete, did that for a little while and had an injury and then came back to finish that career. From there, you know, I've worked in Silicon Valley and in Boston and Route 128, investing in companies in tech and software. And then after graduate school, helped grow a company to a top 40 healthcare startup and see it get acquired. I came from that career, kind of the business career, to academia because I wanted to share my passion for innovation and entrepreneurship. And I thought, where else could you do that but at a university where you have the natural ebb and flow of matriculation and graduation of these fresh minds, eager to learn and eager to go out and make an impact in the world. I think that universities are changing their model by helping and focusing on doing kind of what we're doing here at Vanderbilt, creating experiential immersive learning opportunities while still providing a safety net as well as that academic theory for our students to be much more well-rounded, much more of a, you know, better decision makers and problem solvers, and ultimately providing them the key next steps to kind of get into that career. Mm-hmm. I think also just more specifically, there will be more and more opportunities for other universities and other schools and other programs to provide very key specific learnings around key specific areas. So for those other students, as we mentioned, that might not be on that four-year track, might not have that interest in going to graduate school, they'll be able to get some key skills in certain areas that they might have an interest. Now, it'll make them very specialized, and it'll be on them to continue to grow those skill sets so they don't become obsolete. But ultimately, I think we'll see a complete kind of rounding out of the academic structure in the future based around, you know, skill building and problem solving and ultimately, you know, engaging with tech in new and unique ways.
Awesome stuff. Just very, very finally, what's the most exciting thing that's going on in this building at this moment in time that you can tell me about?
Oh, wow. There's so many exciting things. It's hard to pick one. One of the most exciting companies that I'm excited about is a company started by a student named Noah Robinson. He's a PhD in psychology who's now using virtual reality to help treat patients suffering from opioid addiction without the use of drugs, and using augmented reality and virtual reality environments to help provide a safe space and a place for them to receive therapy in a unique and cool way. It's called VR Help, or VR, so virtual reality help, or very real help. It's kind of a play on words. They've already treated, you know, several hundred patients to date, showing positive effects. They've been published in Science Magazine and have been covered by numerous publications kind of around the world. Again, this was a student that had no business background before he came here, but ultimately had a passion, had an idea, wanted to make an impact, wanted to help people, and we were able to connect him to the right resources, the right faculty members, the right mentorship, and ultimately help him think through in an entrepreneurial sense how to turn this into something real. And now it's being rolled out around the country.
That was Robert Kajewski of The Wondery. Coming up next, the surprising science of meetings.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Now, there were a number of very interesting keynote speeches and breakout sessions here at WorkHuman in Nashville. But the one that caught my eye from the outset was the surprising science of meetings. I caught up with Dr. Steve Rogelberg, the Chancellor's Professor at UNC Charlotte, before his talk.
Well, so for the last 20 years, I've been actively engaged in doing research on this crazy topics of meetings. And I reached a point where I wanted to put my science and the science of others into a book that really could be used to solve the meetings problem. And so that's my book, The Surprising Science of Meetings. And people often ask me, well, why do you have the term surprising? And I think if I had to sum it up, is because people are surprised there actually is a science of meetings.
So how does that work? Because sometimes, you know, I've seen it myself. People think that if they're having meetings, that shows everybody that they're so busy because they have to go from meeting to meeting. You know, I think I read a stat on the back of your book that is it like 55 million meetings happen in the US every day, which is bonkers. How many of those actually have to happen if we are being smart and engaging with the science of meetings?
So that's an interesting question. You know, people generally report that 50% of meeting time is a good use of time. You know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that the elimination of meetings is actually a false goal. That meetings truly are critical for coordination, communication, cooperation, consensus decision making. In many regards, organizational democracy comes to life in meetings. So what we want to do is just eliminate bad meetings. And I think that, you know, what I try to talk about in my book is a variety of techniques and tools that leaders can use to honor the time of individuals when they are in a meeting and to figure out when a meeting is actually necessary. And I can give you an example of the latter. Okay. So one technique, for example, is the agenda. We often think about agendas as being a series of topics. Well, what I advocate for is the agenda should be a series of questions to be answered. So the leader should be in the mindset, well, what questions are we bringing these folks to answer? And that is a really disciplined way of kind of thinking about meetings. A, you know who to invite. B, you know when the meeting is ended because you've answered the questions. You know if the meeting is successful because you've answered the questions. And if you can't generate questions, you don't have a meeting.
That's a really good way of approaching it because, again, and you read so much about this, and I've spoken to a number of people about this as well, where younger members of staff will request meetings with managers and line managers and so on because they want attention. They want FaceTime with their managers, which probably delves deeper into issues within the organization. But if you are a young person within a company and you want to have an effective meeting or you want to get something from a meeting, is there something from that point of view, rather than just being the meeting leader, that you can enforce?
Meeting attendees are pretty much held captive by the meeting leader. Really, so much of the success of the meeting is going to depend on that leader. But still, as an attendee, we have some control. We can model the types of behaviors that we want to see in others, demonstrating active listening, disagreeing with folks when we do, but in a constructive, non-personal way. We can even be back facilitators, right? We could say, hey, Jane, I haven't heard from you. What are your thoughts? So we could really be great examples that hopefully then can ignite this culture. But here's the most uplifting message, I think, for younger people, is that running good meetings is certainly good for attendees, but ultimately everyone can find some meeting that they run. And to the extent that they become better at running meetings, it's gonna be good for their career. As we move up in an organization, it becomes more and more important that we are able to effectively work with and through others. And meetings are really where that action happens. So someone's potential to derail is much higher if they don't develop good meeting skills.
And, you know, you said that you've been studying this area for like 20 years. Obviously, a big disruptor in the workplace has been technology. Where does technology slot into the meetings? I mean, let's just stay in the room for the minute. When people have their laptops out or they have their calendars or projectors and so on, have you noticed any trends in that regard?
Sure. So clearly multitasking is at an all-time high, and I get it. You know, you think about the future of work, you know, clearly people are so overworked that they multitask to try to keep up with the load. But really, I see multitasking in meetings as symptomatic of meeting problems. That if the leader was running shorter, more effective meetings, then people wouldn't multitask because they'd be too engaged. They'd have to be present. So what I really advocate is when a leader is seeing everyone multitasking, take that as feedback that you're doing a crap job and that you need to do better. And there are ways of doing better. But certainly, I think two that jump right out is one, you have to tighten who you invite to meetings. You're probably inviting too many people who don't need to be there. And then your meetings are too long.
So interesting. And then sticking with the tech theme, you know, we know a lot of meetings happen now over FaceTime and Skype and so on. Is there any learnings from that? Do you still have to have the same principles regardless of location?
Basically, the need to be good at running meetings is even higher when you're using technology. The technology, though, does not make meetings good in and of itself. The technology makes meetings more convenient. The technology allows you to bring people in more effectively. But if the leader is not good at running meetings, if they don't embrace their role of a steward of others' time and try to facilitate and plan a meaningful meeting experience, the technology does nothing to make them better. Mm-hmm. So the technology is an opportunity, but ultimately the human is delivering the technology and they have to make sure their house is in order.
And during your research, how did you go about carrying out this research? How do you know so much about this? Have you sat through a billion boring meetings in your lifetime? What way does it work?
Well, I definitely have sat through that, but my research is more systematic than that. So we've done a number of different, I've done dozens of studies, and they involve methodologies such as having people keep diaries of how many meetings they have, and they report on the types of experiences that they had with meetings, what happened. We've even conducted experiments where we bring people into a laboratory and manipulate lateness to meetings and videotape groups working and how that lateness affects folks. So we've really tried to do a host of different studies, and we've been around the globe. You know, thousands and thousands of individuals have been involved in countries from China to Chile to the US to the UK, Ireland, all over the place. Mm-hmm. So we try to have as many methodologies as possible and then try to triangulate and see if the results are similar.
And so is there an exact science to a perfect meeting strategy that regardless of whether you are an SME or a big organization, you can deploy?
Great question. So my book is really different than everyone else's books. If you look at most meeting books, they're very prescriptive. They say do this, 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 and this. That's a false approach. There is no magic formula. What I do in my book is I present a series of tools and techniques. And I want the leader just to think. I want the leader to think about who they are as an individual. I want them to think about the goals of the meeting and who's going to be there and their history with those individuals, and then pick the right tools to fit the job. Okay. And I think that when you just start teaching people a prescriptive approach, they overuse it. For example, agendas. People think that if they have an agenda, they're a good meeting leader. That's not true. 50% of agendas are recycled. And agendas in and of itself does not predict meeting effectiveness. It comes down to what's on the agenda, how was it created, and how you facilitated it. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you have carried out your research, I assume you look at different industries. Is there one industry in particular that kind of stands out as the golden child? And then is there one that is kind of the dunce in the corner that needs to work a bit harder?
That's the exciting thing about meetings. Pretty much everyone's terrible at them.
Yeah, that's great. That makes me feel so much better. Because it is one of, as I said at the beginning, it's one of those things that people like the presenteeism, they like the productivity, the notion of it,
But if you're not being effective in the meeting, it is kind of a waste of time.
It certainly can be.
And so you're here at WorkHuman, as I said, you're going to address the crowd. What do you hope people will take away from this? Because it's always hard in a short presentation to get your full message across. So what are you hoping to try and reach people with today?
Well, I think your questions actually touched upon a lot of the themes that I want to speak about. But I want people to realize that there are evidence-based solutions for addressing the meeting problem, and that there are things that the leader can do, that they can think more carefully about, that they shouldn't just dial in how they run meetings. A little bit of preparation, and this could just be a couple minutes, can really elevate the meeting experience. So if a meeting leader realizes that they're a steward of others' time, if a meeting leader is more careful about who they invite, that the meeting leader doesn't just default to 1 hour meetings because that's the default setting on a calendar program, but they actually choose the right time, that the leader recognizes that they're inherently a host and that they need to welcome people when they come to the meeting and show appreciation. And if a meeting leader recognizes that they need to periodically evaluate their meetings, they should check in with others to say, hey, how are these meetings going? Any ideas for making them better? And that's the epitome of being a good steward. And that's the kind of stuff that I hope to communicate.
And finally, then, as we look towards the future of work, which is kind of a buzz term at the moment, everyone's looking ahead, and there's this notion that it's going to be run by robots and we're just going to be the little pawns. Will meetings evolve much further than where they are now? Like, and I mean that more so than just using different technology tools. Will the nature of meetings, will the objective from meetings, do you envisage that changing over the next 5 to 10 years?
How we do the meetings might change given technology, but the fundamental drive of humans to get together to discuss things has been, I'm assuming, going on since cave people. This is just what the social condition of being human is about. So I think people will always meet in collectives, they will always gather, and but the ways that we do it will change. And so the fundamental need to make those gatherings as valuable and meaningful as possible will be with us for hundreds and hundreds of years more.
That was Dr. Steve Rogelberg, author of The Surprising Science of Meetings. And that's all we have time for this week. I will have more for you from Nashville on next week's program. If you missed any of this week's show, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get the podcast from, because there is an extended version of many of the interviews up there for your listening pleasure. Patrick Egan is up next here on News Talk. I'll chat to you next week.